Hey, how you doing today? I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Great show for you today, and I have a special guest that I just connected with, and I'm so excited to be able to cover this topic that we're going to talk about because, can I tell you, it's important, okay? I have my guest today with me, Barry Ray. He is with the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition, and we are going to be jumping right in and talking about GM mosquitoes. Barry, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Karen.
Hi. So can we just get right to it? I want to tell people, if you go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, you can find out all of the great things Barry has been involved with, including being involved in 2010 with the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And certainly sounds like you have a great passion for the environment, especially the Florida Keys, Barry.
Well, the environment calls you. it's one of those things that when you want to protect what you love, you either step up and do it or you watch it go by the wayside. So many of us of the same background and cut from the same cloth is bound together. And I want to make one comment right at the beginning. We lost our poster child, our troubadour, Mila DeMere. And that was very unfortunate. Lost her this year. And we hope everybody goes and signs her petition. We want 1 million for Mila. So
That sounds good.
On your site there.
We posted a link at Responsible Eating and Living for this show. Anybody who's interested in the link, or they could go directly to the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition also. But I also wanted to note, before we get into the details of this particular issue regarding genetically modified mosquitoes, that you, Barry, you have a master's of science in electrical engineering, so you understand some of the science that's going on with this particular issue too, and I think that's important.
Yeah, I have a master's of science, but you know, we don't once you grow into a career, you don't limit yourself to where your original education was, and I haven't. I've been, the Deepwater Horizon forced me into areas that I really hadn't planned on going into, everything from resiliency to, emergency response networks, things like that here in the Keys that I helped participate in. And we actually gathered about 400 people that became HAZWOPR trained so that we could be responsive down here. It was one of the things we did originally. We came up with techniques and systems to be able to combat oil if it did arrive on our shores, very unique, novel things that we were looking at. Together, I worked with the PhD that was in charge of marine science down at the community college here in Keys, the Florida Keys Community College. And from there, we were assaulted with another challenge, and that was the genetically modified mosquito. And this at first sounded like a great idea. We all went, and I actually tuned in from here in Isle Mirada, where I live, about 90 miles north of Key West, and listened to the meeting of OxyTech presenting this great technology that was going to basically release genetically modified mosquitoes. They were going to go out and mate with females, and there would be no offspring. Sounds wonderful. Does not work that way. And that's where the problems began, is when questions started to be asked of OxyTech. And instead of getting a clear answer, you got a song and dance and a sidestep, and this went on. And it grew. And so at one point, Key West says, look, we don't feel comfortable. The answers aren't real clear. We want you to show us three things. What's your protocol? What's your criteria for success or failure? By the way, who's your regulatory body? And they couldn't answer any of the three. So Key West basically gave them a vote of no confidence, in effect, by saying, we object to you releasing those mosquitoes until you tell us these answers. They moved the trial at that point from Key West to a small community called Key Haven. Well, that raised really large red flags at that point. Why did you move the trial? Well, here now they're in the county jurisdiction. So, and the county really was kind of hands off. So politics play a role in all these things, and they play a role in our regulatory agencies as well, which is a very disconcerting proposition when you consider they should be scientific and immune from politics, but they are not. So what really happens after that is that community of Key Haven became very educated and objected very loudly. Basically, OxyTech and our mosquito control department, who was lockstep, the de facto champions of OxyTech down here, would go in and do surveys that were extremely biased. And they would come out, oh, well, the neighborhood's overwhelmingly in favor. Well, we went behind them and did a very objective survey of about 60% of the population there, and it was 3-1 against. So it was very, very clear that there was a lot of, you know, manipulation and going on. And it continues today. I'll talk a little bit more about that when we start talking about the Cayman and Brazil.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. I want to get to the history of the GM mosquito and OxyTech, because mm-hmm. I know you're concerned about the Florida Keys. That's your home. You love that area and you want to protect it. But this is a global world. We're all connected in so many ways. And OxyTech has experimented already with GM mosquitoes.
Yeah. Yes, they have. They've released these mosquitoes. We do not know the long-term effects of what they've done. Nobody does, and that's never been studied. There's been a lot of things that have been omitted out of the study that are quite concerning. They've never studied the bite of the female. This mosquito's been around for 12 years. They have never performed any clinical trials to look at the bite of this female. And we recently discovered that four strains of amino acid in the modification that they put into this mosquito actually match up perfectly with allergens, known allergens, four known allergens to humans. And this is brand new. This is this week. So that becomes very scary when you know they've neglected doing clinical trials. What you have here is you have a company that is a for-profit company on a march to the market. And all they care about is that goal line, getting to profitability. And everything else gets tossed by the wayside, all your science, all your protocols, all your ethics, everything. And that's really apparent in everything that goes on with this company. And they're owned by Intrexon now in the United States. So let me talk a little bit about what we've learned this week from the Cayman.
Please.
All of OxyTech's reports, both Brazil and the Cayman, always come back glowingly. All right, 90% plus suppression of mosquitoes and everything. Well, that's great. That would be wonderful if that's really what was going on. But a series, 128 pages of emails came out over the past week from Dr. Alan Wheeler, who works at MCRU, which is or MRCU rather, which is the Mosquito Control and Research Unit, rather, MCRU, down in the Cayman. And they basically highlight all these differences in what the MCRU found versus what OxyTech was publicizing. And both Brazil and the Cayman took issue with the scientific practice of OxyTech in terms of how they were projecting numbers and performance and suppression. So OxyTech was claiming 90% suppression. MCRU at best saw 62%, and in some cases it was down at 51%. So when we look at Brazil, the gentleman Danilo Cavallo, who was in charge of overseeing the analytics for that those projects, three different venues where they tested, they all said plus 90%, you know, came out of OxyTech for suppression. He took issue with that number and actually made the statement that he had issues with their scientific practice, and his numbers came out somewhere between 60 and 70% suppression. So here, what the purpose of that whole conversation is, you have a company that represents one thing, and this is just one particular issue. But yet, when you actually peel the onion, you're actually able to get data. You find out it's really not what they have been promoting, you know, in public. And one other thing that the OxyTech did when we were able to get our hands on the contract, they had our mosquito control district, you know, looking at here in the Keys. That contract had them controlling 100% of the data that was published to the public. So we had no control over what was published. They did. So that's why they're responses are always so glowing, how their performance in the field. And, you know, when you're dealing with you know, an agent that is not trustworthy, you have to start from that point of view. And that's, you know, so every piece of data, every piece of information that comes out, you have to question, and you have to question more severely. You can't have any trust whatsoever. And that's really what we've, you know, come to believe now about this company. We've worked
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that they're lying about the success rate. It's not 90%. It's more like 60 or maybe 60 to 70. Isn't that good, though, 60 to 70%? I mean, we have a serious mosquito problem. Isn't some amount of suppression better than none?
Look, any of these SIT methods, you know, they that stands for sterile insect technique. Yes, 60% suppression would probably be a good suppression. You can't count on that consistently and so it doesn't even perform as well as the chemicals that, you know, typically are used. And what it doesn't perform as well as is just boots on the ground, self-policing, dumping water around your property, things like that, that actually work extremely well and are very cost effective because you engage the community to do part of that. So even if it's 60%, the problem when you start finding misrepresentations are that you have to look at some of the other concerns. Okay, mm-hmm. They splice this gene. All right, what happens is these mosquitoes die in a couple of days, but they really don't. When I investigated during the first, you know, regulatory review through the FDA, I found a chart that showed that up to about 18% of the mosquitoes live for 40 days, long enough for females to take two blood meals and lay two clutches of eggs. Now, let me remind you, this female bite has never been clinically tested. All right. And we know that there are amino acid strains that are identical to known human allergens. So you start getting a larger set of information and a larger set of concerns because they say, oh, it's harmless and all the mosquitoes die. And they really don't. So these mosquitoes are actually impressing their DNA into the wild population. And there are no long-term studies of what those evolutionary effects can be. We have no idea whatsoever because OxyContin doesn't want
to. Yes, I'm very concerned about the allergens that are found. The amino acid-related allergens that are in the female. So if a female that is remains alive bites, mm-hmm. someone could be affected and have a terrible allergic reaction, and we have no data on that or any kind of either way, whether it's harmful or not. And we don't know along the food chain either what happens when other bugs and birds consume those mosquitoes that have been genetically modified.
No, those studies have been pretty much non-existent as well. You know, OxyContin says they've done some studies, but there's no real evidence. There's nothing they've ever provided as far as, well, here's a published paper, here's anything. And another thing you won't find is any third-party objective review or replication of OxyContin's claims. Just doesn't exist. And so that's pretty daunting when you start looking at a track record of 12 years. That there's no third-party corroboration of anything they've ever claimed. It just doesn't exist.
Okay, so how is the EPA involved?
Okay, so originally the FDA was the regulatory body, and they went through a whole process. I actually met with the science team up in D.C. over this issue, and we asked them very clearly, look, process them through what we call an environmental impact statement, which is a regiment where objective scientists come in, help devise a way to evaluate the technology. And there's a lot of independence in that, a lot of, you know, outside, you know, input. So it's a very, you know, high hurdle, if you will. And that never happened. Basically, what happened was it became politicized I'll tell you the first part of the story. I asked them what scared them the most about the whole process that we were going through. And they said, oh, it'll become political and they'll force us to release a finding of no significant impact. And we'll have to put that out. Well, 11 months later, that's exactly what happened. The Energy and Commerce Committee grilled the chief scientist, Luciana Borio from the FDA. 2 weeks later, the finding of no significant impact came out. we were able to even withstand that, and the release didn't go on because of all the work we'd done on the ground here in the Keys. And we actually had a referendum scheduled. And so the whole issue went to referendum, two referendums, one for the small target community where the release was going to happen, and the other countywide. Well, we only had a month to try and educate our county. We lost on the county numbers, and we won by about a 3-1 margin in the community where the release was supposed to occur. So, again, with a little bit of education, people reject this technology. So what happened after that was the FDA, in their infinite wisdom, decided that they could not regulate this. They were trying to regulate it under a rule called an animal drug, and it was anything but an animal drug. So we explained that to them very early on. So they decided we were right after all the turmoil, and the referendum was, you know, pretty much, you know, on the border, and they didn't like any of that. And so they turned the hot potato over to the EPA, said, well, it's really, you know, these genetically modified species, if they're just killing off their own species, well, they're really an animal pesticide. They're not an animal drug. Now, if that animal was, you know, curing some illness or something like that, then they'd be an animal drug. So the FDA got rid of the hot potato and gave it to the EPA. So the EPA has it now, and we're in what we call an open comment period, where anyone in the U.S. can, well, even beyond anybody globally, can comment to the EPA. They're looking for, you know, scientific input and, you know, other input. People with standing basically just saying, look, I object because, you know, I don't want you to experiment on my body. Both these agencies, EPA and FDA, are under Health and Human Services. There is a rule called the Common Rule, and that simply states that you cannot experiment on somebody's body without their informed consent. Well, what effectively happens when you release females that are going to bite you, and you become part of this experiment, and you're going to have no informed consent. If the EPA approves this, there's no provision for them to come back and say, oh, but we want you to make sure everybody has informed consent that's going to be in the area because they could get bitten. That's just not in there. You're part of the experiment, whether you like it or not. So how Health and Human Services manipulates the use of the Common Rule, and this came out of the Nuremberg trials years ago, back in World War II. So this has been around for a long time. How they do that, we don't know. But they do. They somehow see subjectively around things when they don't want to use it. And, you know, we are petitioning that basically this requires informed consent by anybody in that area.
Do you have any state protection that can make a difference if the EPA actually decides to allow the GM mosquitoes?
That's very interesting. Yes, the state has jurisdiction over any pesticides that are used here. So this, even though it would come out of the EPA, there would have to be an MSDS sheet, you know, for this particular, quote, pesticide, and the state has to sign off on it. We don't have any way to judge right now which way the state would weigh in on that. We're feeling that they probably would permit it, but it's hard for us to say. You know, we're obviously going to wage that battle as well as we need.
Let's talk about mosquitoes for a minute. We were talking about GM mosquitoes, but just the subject of mosquitoes in general. Mosquitoes and other bugs, Lyme, ticks have been in the news quite a bit, and mosquitoes, and we're reading that more and more, they're more prevalent all over the place, maybe because of global warming, whatever the reason. There seem to be more, especially in this country, in cooler regions than ever before. And mosquitoes are, I think I read, they kill more people than anything. Should we be afraid of mosquitoes, and what should we be doing?
Well, you know, that's a really good point. All right, let's talk about two things here. First, the mosquitoes. The mosquitoes, absolutely, as the globe warms, these were tropical mosquitoes for the most part. And if you look at where they roam, it's basically that warm band across, you know, on either side of the equator. And this is what's called an Aedes aegypti. That's the only solution that genetically modified mosquitoes have right now. There are several other mosquitoes that fall close into that range. Now, these mosquitoes are what we call vectors, and they transmit these viruses called arboviruses for the most part. Now, you may be familiar with malaria. That's a different, the Anopheles mosquito is a little different, and it pretty much transmits the malaria virus. All right, but this is these Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, which is also known as the Asian tiger. They are tropical mosquitoes. The aegypti pretty much feeds exclusively off of humans, lives in your carport or under your, porch, or lives around humans, can breed in a bottle cap. I mean, they're dangerous mosquitoes. And globally, mosquito vector deaths are about 750,000 annually. There's a whole series of other mosquitoes, too, that can transmit these, quote, arboviruses like Zika and dengue and West Nile and yellow fever and all those. There's another version called the Culex that's very concerning, the southern house mosquito. All of them are finding the habitat much more favorable. And the Aedes aegypti is actually traveling north, both here and in Europe. So it's a big concern, and it needs to be. But there are other solutions as well. And we'll talk about those in a second here. And the other solutions don't necessarily come with the risks that genetically modified do. But when you look at, these mosquitoes, all right, I don't want to get too far off the subject here, but let's go back to, the other alternatives that we have when we look at this. All right, we have another solution called irradiated insects, and most people are very familiar with that from agriculture and feel very comfortable. It's a pretty benign process. Mosquitoes are completely sterile when they release them, and they use those to kill off, when they mate, no offspring survive. We also have a solution that's made here in the U.S. by the University of Kentucky. Now there's been a spinoff for-profit company called Mosquito Mate that markets this now. But it's based on a bacteria that's harmless to humans because your body's too hot for the bacteria to live in it. And many mosquitoes are born with this bacteria. And about 65% of insects worldwide already have it. So what they do is they infect males only. And when they release males, it's about 1 in 250,000 as a female. But as I said, the bacteria is harmless. And what happens is the males, when they mate with females, 100% of the offspring die. They just are not viable. They never hatch. So we have alternatives to this. And we end up, in this battle, over a product. Because a for-profit company wants to drive it to market, and they've done just millions and millions of dollars of marketing. And that's the battle we're in, not whether there's something sensible out there, already available, by the way, because the EPA has approved one version of the Wolbachia solution for 22 states already. And they would have approved it for the entire United States, but it was really only tested in colder climates. And then we've already trialed the Aedes aegypti version down here in the Keys. And there's no controversy. People look at it, they learn about it, and they feel very comfortable with it because of the basically zero risk level for us. So, you bring up good points about, the climate and the fact that these mosquitoes are now infiltrating. But one thing they don't tell you about genetically modified mosquitoes is the fact that they're made using tetracycline as this antidote. I kind of went a little fast in the conversation. When they design the mosquito, when they insert this gene that makes them enable to, quote, have offspring, right? That's what they call a lethal gene. What they did is they made them dependent on tetracycline, an antibiotic, the most prevalent antibiotic on the planet, by the way, the most used antibiotic on the planet. So they made them dependent on this antibiotic. But the antibiotic, this whole strategy of using this antibiotic assumes that there's no bacteria on the mosquito. So we have the potential with this mosquito because we have a doctor down here, Dr. Jack Norris, who's worked on this subject extensively. And there is a likelihood that this mosquito could be promoting antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Wow.
Right. Now, that is a death rate of about 700,000 people a year globally. Even worse, the people that get affected with like MRSA, I have a friend that lives one street over here, and he had to have knee replacements. He was he's a Super Bowl ring, front line for the Pittsburgh Steelers, right? Great guy. And he couldn't get his knees replaced because every time they put him in, MRSA would come back up. So he's in a wheelchair.
Hmm.
All right. So we find a lot of complications out of antibiotic resistance. It's a much, much bigger problem than mosquito vectors as a threat, you know, globally. And in the year 2050, they project that deaths from antibiotic-resistant bacteria will be 10 million a year versus basically equivalent to what mosquitoes are now. So are we creating a bigger problem by this strategy to use tetracycline as the antidote than we are solving by being able to deplete mosquitoes with this particular technology, a technology that has alternatives that are more effective, cost less, and don't come with all the risks associated with it? So I don't know. I have to question something like that. And why are we doing this?
Okay, so what can we as individuals first we need to respond to the EPA. There's a link at the website responsibleeatingandliving.com for this interview. The deadline to comment is June 7th, 2018. And if you can, I encourage you to put your comments there and also sign the petition to stop GMO mosquitoes. But aside from that, what can we do to keep mosquitoes at bay and off of our skin?
Great question. All right. Now, the traditional way is one of the best ways, all right? When it rains around your house, you know, and sometimes that rain goes on for days, but it ends. When it ends, go out there and police your yard or around your area. Make sure there's no standing water. Pick up any trash. Trash is the worst part of it, you know, that trash just laying around collects water when you're not even paying attention to it. And these mosquitoes can breed, like I said, in a bottle cap, literally. So, you know, you want to be able to, the only way they can breed is if they have water. And this particular mosquito, what they do is they lay their eggs at the water line. And if the water recedes, the eggs go dormant until the water rises again. And then they wake up and basically hatch. So it's a very creative mosquito. It actually started over in the north part of, in the arid area of the Sahara. They believed that it was moist there at one point in time, and as it became more arid, they moved towards humans and evolved in that direction. And that's why they came up with these techniques to lay their eggs. So police your own area. Secondly, wear long clothes when you go out. The Aedes aegypti tend to feed during the day. They're very docile. They run away at the slightest movement. You know, they're very timid. And, you know, so they're a little different than most mosquitoes like that. Its cousin, the Albopictus, will attack you in a second. They're very aggressive. So, you know, different behavior there. But wearing long clothes, wearing repellents, policing your own areas, those are the things that you can do. You can also, most places have mosquito control. If you start having a mosquito problem, we tend to call our mosquito control. We like our mosquito control, even though we're in a battle with them over this issue. We believe in them wholeheartedly that they have kept us safe and allowed us to live in these islands that, you know, we have 45 different varieties of mosquitoes, and some of them you think would carry you away down here. They're so aggressive. But, you know, so you depend on your mosquito control to be part of the solution. And unfortunately, sometimes they have to use, you know, techniques where they spray. We don't like that. But, you know, sometimes that's the only technique that really works, believe it or not. And experts in this particular field on these sterile insect techniques will tell you that none of the sterile insect techniques will work if there's an outbreak. You will have to spray. You'll have to use other methods, you know, boots on the ground methods. Here in the Keys are where, you know, we have our mosquito control workers come out and just constantly work with the community on how to eradicate these mosquitoes, and they keep coming out and testing and spraying and doing all that in concert with the community. So, and that works most effectively.
I'm not a fan of pesticides myself, and here in New York, we have some spraying that goes on I think, every year for mosquitoes. And you have to know what website to go to find out the schedule for the spraying to see if it's going to hit your particular area on a certain day, which is kind of frustrating. I would like a little more communication so that everybody knows when the spray is coming, so you can be indoors, you can keep your windows closed and wait till it's passed. So we could
maybe even
we could do a better job with
little,
that.
Maybe they have a little music thing like the ice cream cart to let you know they're coming, huh?
Oh, yes. More like ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Yeah.
There you go.
Mosquito spray music. I'm going to work on that. Well, Barry, thank you for coming on the show on short notice. I really appreciate it. This is a very important issue, and I'm glad you're working on it.
Well, I appreciate you helping to get the word out. I encourage everybody, please take a moment to go to your website and find the link for the EPA. Make a comment. It's open until June 7th. And also, please join us on the petition at change.org that Mila DeMare wrote. And let's get 1 million for Mila. And talk to your elected officials. Tell them your concerns. Let them, you know, be aware that this is a real subject and that they need to learn about it and understand it and defend us against it, because I do not believe this technology is safe. And until they prove it so, it should not be regulated for permit.
Thank you, Barry Ray, for joining me today. All the best.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, take care. Whoa! What did you think of that, folks? I hope that you take action and write the EPA and sign the petition. Would you do that, please? Thank you. All right. Second part of the show starts now, and I'm calling it The Color Purple. You may remember, I guess it was a couple years back, I discovered purple sweet potatoes. And we were in Florida at the time, actually. I went to Josh's Organic Farmers Market in North Hollywood, and we found purple sweet potatoes. And we were staying in a beach house, and we used a microwave to cook them. Now, I'm not a fan of microwaves. We don't own one in the house, but when we're traveling, we do use it. And amazingly, these were delicious. I couldn't believe how wonderful they were. And then I was on a search to find purple sweet potatoes. Do you know the acronym for purple sweet potatoes is PSP? Yes, it is. Sometimes just PP. I'm laughing saying that out loud. But sometimes it's just used in research reports, scientific reports, sometimes refer to purple sweet potatoes as PSP or just PP. Okay. Now, I discovered a number of things about purple sweet potatoes. They're kind of hard to find, and you really have to look for them. And a number of people had emailed me about where I might find them. You can Google purple sweet potatoes and find them online. Even jet.com will deliver organic purple sweet potatoes for you now. They are available online if you cannot find them in your stores. So I did a little research and learned a little bit about purple sweet potatoes, particularly the Stokes purple. So purple sweet potatoes have been around, just not very prevalent in the United States. And there have been Japanese varieties and other varieties in other countries. The purple sweet potato, the Stokes purple, actually was propagated by Mike Sizemore. And he originally worked in catching car thieves for the state government in North Carolina. And North Carolina is the largest sweet potato producing state. Did you know that? They're not only just unfortunately producing a lot of pigs, but we don't want to talk about pigs today. We want to talk about sweet potatoes. And he won a prize for his sweet potatoes. These were just regular sweet potatoes, the yellow-orange variety. And some woman gave him some deep purple sweet potatoes when he won that prize back in 2003. and he ended up propagating them. And he created a purple sweet potato variety that he trademarked. And he got a patent for it. Now, I'm not someone who really likes the idea of getting patents on food, because food is food. How more profound can I get? I'm kind of uncomfortable with patents, but there is a patent on the purple sweet potato by this particular guy, and it's now getting more and more available. So I just picked up some Stokes organic purple sweet potatoes at Whole Foods, and I'm enjoying them quite a bit. Have you had purple sweet potatoes yet? So I heard about purple sweet potatoes. That's fun to say, isn't it? Purple sweet potatoes. I heard about sweet potatoes recently when I was working with the Food Revolution Network on their 7th annual Food Revolution Summit. And Dr. William Lee talked about the benefits of purple sweet potatoes. And there have been some studies a couple of years back where the compounds found in purple sweet potatoes may kill colon cancer stem cells and limit the spread of cancer. Well, whoa, my antenna went up when I heard that. Killing stem cells? So if you're familiar with cancer, stem cells are like the root of the cancer. Just like when you're trying to remove weeds from a garden. And, you know, I don't want to knock weeds, because some weeds are wonderful plants, but some of them are very persistent when you don't want them in your garden. And the real key is to get them at the root to try and keep them from spreading. And the same thing is with cancer. The stem cell is the root. And there are many treatments like surgery that don't always get at the root. And then years later, or months later, depending on how aggressive it is, you may have a recurrence. So the study is interesting. It's not entirely a proof about purple sweet potatoes. The studies were done in vivo and in vitro. In vitro means in like a test tube, and in vivo means on a live species. This particular study that I'm referring to tested purple sweet potatoes and purple sweet potato extract on mice. I'm also not a fan of animal studies, but sometimes when the results are interesting, I take notice. And this particular one was one of those studies that was particularly interesting. So some of the magic ingredients in purple sweet potatoes: anthocyanins. Anthocyanins, that's a fun word to say, right? And chlorogenic acid and resistant starch. We talked about resistant starch many times on this program, and this is the wonderful thing in all potatoes that give a great health benefit and have been shown to reduce the risk of colon cancer in particular. Well, this particular study, it's in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry, and it was published in December of 2015. Anthocyanin-containing purple flesh potatoes suppress colon tumorigenesis via elimination of colon cancer stem cells. You can check that article out, or at least the abstract. I think you have to buy the whole article if you want to get all the details, but it's very encouraging. And purple potatoes, I love them. So it's like a bonus that they have the potential to kill stem cells, right? Now, the question you may have next is, what's the best way to prepare sweet potatoes? And this is not just purple potatoes, but any color. You can bake them, you can boil them, you can fry them. There are lots of different options, right? Well, frying is not the way to go. When you fry any food, you're using a very high temperature, and that's the best recipe to create cancer-promoting acrylamides. when you're eating sweet potatoes, especially to reduce your risk of cancer, you don't want to cook them at such a high temperature that you create acrylamide. So frying is a no-no. Now, the question is, do you want to bake them or boil them or steam them? And I've read that boiling may actually be the best way to retain the antioxidant power as compared to steaming or roasting. And baking as well, compared to boiling. The boiling actually helps thin out the cell walls and gelatinize the starch, which may enhance the bioavailability of nutrients. And at the same time, the glycemic index of boiled sweet potatoes has been found to be only half that of baking or roasting. I think that's why baking and roasting potatoes taste sweeter. But you know, the bottom line is baking, boiling, steaming, they're all incredibly healthy ways to get the benefits of sweet potatoes, and you can choose any one of these methods. Just don't fry them or deep fry them, because that will lead to the formation of the acrylamide. So I like to make sweet potato toast. Now, you may have seen the sweet potato toast videos go around Pinterest and other social media platforms where you slice a sweet potato, and this can be any color, yellow, orange, purple, and you slice it sometimes lengthwise is what I've seen, in like quarter inch wide or half inch thick slices, and you put them in the toaster and you toast them until they're cooked, which takes about 5 minutes for a slice. And I tried it and I was like, okay, this is interesting. But I found it really inconvenient because I want more than two slices of the potato. I like eating the entire potato. And when there are other people around, you want to feed them all. And I like to serve everybody all at once. So what I end up doing is I slice the potato or several potatoes. I put it on a parchment lined baking sheet and I bake them for about a half hour. Now, I've read that ideally, I usually use 400 degrees Fahrenheit to bake my baked potatoes, sweet potato toast, all those things. If you cook them at a lower temperature, like 350, you'll have to cook them a little longer, but they'll stay moist. And it really depends on what you like. Now, some people might say that there's some acrylamide that forms when you're baking. And the interesting thing is, I think the temperature for acrylamide formation is somewhere around 250. I'm not sure the exact number. But if you stuck a thermometer in a lot of these foods, especially the ones that are wet, they don't reach the high temperature of the oven. They stay cooler. So there's really less likelihood of forming acrylamide or much that would cause any problem. Now, there's other interesting things about purple sweet potatoes. They're not just delicious and healthy, but they're actually being used for food and beverage colors. And I found this fascinating. For a few decades now, there have been people fighting against the artificial colors and flavorings and artificial anything in so many of our prepared food products. And artificial colors can be very unhealthy to consume, especially for children who are consuming perhaps more of them in their candies and other kinds of prepared food that have bright colors in them. Well, sweet potatoes, purple sweet potatoes, are a new kind of coloring, and it's good for you. It has antioxidant-rich substances with health benefits. So this is a great thing. The only thing that I don't like about is this is going to be competition for all of us who want to eat our sweet potatoes rather than have them used in colorings. But here's the thing, and here's where I like to connect the dots. If we all consumed a plant-based diet, that means mostly plants, if not all plants, in our diet and stopped raising animals for food, we would have lots more landmass to grow more sweet potatoes that we could use for eating, that we could use for food and beverage colors, and there might even be some left over for extraction for medicinal purposes. So the bottom line is, stop eating animals, stop raising animals, and we'd have a lot more landmass to do beautiful things, beautiful purple things. Now, these same purple pigments, you find them in other purple foods, like those deep purple or black carrots, and they also are being used in the food and beverage industry for colors. And what is that ingredient that gives us that gorgeous purple? It's that anthocyanin pigment. And they are using PSP, that's purple sweet potatoes, PSP. They're using them in fruit drinks and vitamin waters, ice cream and yogurt. And apparently, using this as a pigment, it has a very neutral taste, which makes it beneficial because it doesn't conflict with the foods that it's being used in. And have you ever heard of carmine? Carmine has been considered a natural coloring, but I haven't been a fan of it because it's extracted from cochineal insects. So it's from the shell of the cochineal insect, and it takes 2,500 bugs to produce 1 ounce of cochineal extract that's used in ice creams and yogurts and candy beverages and other foods, and it's also in lipsticks. When I first started looking for cosmetics that were natural and didn't have artificial ingredients in them, I wanted them to be vegan, and some of the redder colors I didn't know for a while, but then I learned were colored with this carmine, this insect color. And this is where PSP, purple sweet potatoes, can be advantageous. Now, apparently the PSP anthocyanins, that's the pigment, that's also the ingredient that fights the cancer. They're hard to extract, and they're looking for better ways to process the purple sweet potatoes for the color. And I've been reading, and it says that byproducts of this process include starch and fiber, and they're always looking for what can we do with the byproducts we want. Now, you could compost anything, and that would be beautiful. But some are looking to use the byproducts in animal feed. And when we're connecting the dots and trying not to encourage the consumption of animals by people, this could be a little problematic. It can also be used in biofuel production. So there are lots of things that we can do with purple sweet potatoes and the byproducts of using purple sweet potatoes as a coloring. I'm fascinated by it all. All right, so let's talk about something related to purple sweet potatoes and other foods that have these bright pigments that give lovely colors to food and can also be used as food coloring. What happens when you have some of these foods and you spill them on your clothing and you get stains? There's lots of information on the internet about how to remove certain kinds of stains. And I'm a big believer in having certain things in my home. My chem lab is very small. It consists of water, baking soda, vinegar, hydrogen peroxide. I also have a little alcohol. And that's about it. And when it comes to stains, I'm going to tell you a secret. The most important ingredient for removing a stain and using natural ingredients that aren't going to harm the environment. Are you ready for this? The secret ingredient is time. I mean, T-I-M-E, time. I've removed the most difficult stains by allowing them to soak in some kind of solution with detergent and maybe some other things over a day or 2 days. It's amazing. It just takes time. But we live in a society where everything is in a rush. We have to slow down sometimes if we want to do things right. So I just had this fantastic yellow, bright yellow stain on a light blue sweater that I love. And I was very sad because I love this sweater and I wanted the stain to be out. And so the stain was on the front of the sweater and somehow I got it on the sleeve. And I'm thinking to myself, this must have been some food that I was preparing that had turmeric in it. And the fascinating thing, I kind of like to play with some of my chemicals in my little bathroom lab, peroxide and vinegar and baking powder. When you change the pH, and what's the pH? Raise your hand. pH is the measurement of acidity or alkalinity of a water-based solution. So when I get the stain wet, in an acid environment, the stain may be yellow. And when the environment gets a little alkaline, it turns more red or purple. It's kind of fun to put something on it like baking powder and make the stain environment more alkaline, and it turns kind of red purpley, and then I'll throw vinegar on it and it'll turn the color back to yellow. Now, some say that if the stain is actually acid-based, when you put an acid on it like vinegar, you'll set it. And I can't say that I've experienced that. You'll have to try an experiment at home. But what I like to do is wet the stain, put my laundry detergent in it, and I use a plant-based soap detergent with no animal ingredients. And then I'll pour, depending on what it is, I'll pour a little white vinegar on it. Sometimes I'll pour a little hydrogen peroxide on it, which is a very mild acid. White vinegar is a little stronger. And then I might let it soak. Sometimes if I don't see anything happening, I might change the chemistry and put a little baking soda on it. Baking soda and vinegar together can work. One's basic or alkaline and one's acidic. But the key is to let it soak. I have a little small tub. I fill it with water, put the detergent in there, and let the vinegar or baking powder or baking soda, whatever I've used, I let it sit on the stain. And lo and behold, after a period of time, usually I let it go overnight. Sometimes I have to like rinse it and start again. The stain goes away. So the key is to be patient. I think just like in reducing risk for disease, we like to use certain foods to prevent disease and reduce risk. And I think the key with stains, first off, is to prevent them, sometimes by wearing clothes you don't care about when you prepare food or wearing an apron. I don't always pick up those good habits and I get a little sloppy, and that's how the stains happen for me. But I've got a way to get them out. So some of these acid-based indicators, curcumin, which I mentioned before, is turmeric. It turns from yellow at a pH of 7.4 to red at a pH of 8.6. And then anthocyanin, which is the plant pigment that we find in purple sweet potatoes, red cabbage, and other purpley red foods. I remember Dr. Michael Greger putting out a post on his website, nutritionfacts.org, and he was saying that you could use the juice of red purple cabbage, red or purple cabbage, or the cooking water, and you could pour it in your toilet bowl and you could urinate. And depending on the color that it would change to, you could see if your urine was alkaline or acid. There are people that talk about how you can monitor your health and see your digestion and what you're eating, whether your urine is alkaline or acidic. The ideal is you want it to be slightly neutral, maybe a little alkaline, and it varies during the day. And I don't know that you want to waste your purple cabbage water on trying this, but it was kind of a fun article that he wrote about. Yes, so there we go with sweet potatoes, purple sweet potatoes, stains, anthocyanins, killing your stem cells. That's a lot to digest, isn't it? So I hope you take the time with regards to the first part of the show to write to the EPA and sign the petition to stop GMO mosquitoes. We need more information on them before we let them out to bite all of us. Thank you for joining me today. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me your comments and questions to info@realmeals.org. Enjoy your purple sweet potatoes. Have a delicious week.